Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for Thursday, 21st day of August, year of our Lord, 2014. Let's start with the metals markets. Not a particularly happy day. Gold is down $14.80 per ounce to $1,277.60. Silver's off a penny. That's not bad. $19.54 for silver. Platinum is down $8 to $1,424. Palladium is up $11 to $881. Dow Jones is up 73 points to 17,052. NASDAQ is up 5 points to 4,532. New York Stock Exchange is up 39 points to 10,988. U.S. dollar index is down 10.10 to 82.15. That's almost a surprise. I mean, the dollar's been strong in recent weeks and rising. Here we have a day where gold is down, and the dollar is also down. It's a little surprising to me. Crude oil is up 60 cents to $94.05 per barrel, but still crude oil is basically down over the last few weeks. Interesting times. What do you make of it? Don't know exactly. I can tell you this, though. There are some people that are certainly gloating over the good fortune of the Dow Jones average, for example, back up over 17,000. Gold is taking a hit, right? It's not major, but it's irritating, annoying, significant. And there's some people who gloat about that, and they will gloat about gold bugs in general and say, you people don't know. See, you don't know what you're doing. I'm going to explain to you my understanding, my fundamental understanding of the problem we have in the markets today. And this understanding has been my opinion for 5-6 years now. This is the key element, the cornerstone of my outlook, for my outlook, in terms of what's happening in the stock markets, what's happening in the metals markets, and so on. And I was helped to understand this by John Williams of ShadowStats.com. John Williams, I read one of his articles, again, at least 5, maybe 6 years ago. And I don't remember what the numbers were at the time. It may be that the total debt at the time was, national debt was allegedly $10 trillion. And Williams would explain, no, it was actually like $35 or $40 trillion. I first heard that and I first realized what that meant, it essentially put me into a state of almost shock and certainty that the day is coming when gold is going to be a very, very good thing to have. And paper debt instruments are going to be a terrible place to have your wealth. You will almost certainly lose most of your assets if it's stored in paper. And the reason today, we'll take the numbers we have today. If we listen to the government, the national debt right now is about $17 trillion. If you divide that total debt by the number of people in this country, about 317 million, you wind up with an average, a fair share of $50,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. Your individual fair share of the national debt's about 50 grand. Got it? You might. Of course, if you had a family of four, your fair share for your family will be about 200,000. Do you have that? Maybe not. And in fact, even if you do, you look out the street, look out the window, watch the people walking by on the street, and ask how many of these people have $50,000 in assets that they are capable or inclined to give to the government to pay off the national debt. And if you stop to think about it for a moment, you say, wait a second, you get 50 grand out of me and 50 grand out of the guy across the street and 50 grand out of his wife and 50 grand out of each of his kids, and you're going to get keep on going across the country and say, baby, we got to have that $50,000 from each of you for good old Uncle Sam. How many are you going to voluntarily supply your fair share of the national debt? Now, it's not impossible that $17 trillion can be paid, especially if we held out, if the payments were extended over a period of, say, a decade, and they only took $5,000 each year from me and $5,000 from you, that's in addition to your current taxes and whatever, but if they took $5,000 from each of us every year for the next 10 years, and we didn't go any further into debt, that would be the other criteria, of course, in theory, the $17 trillion could be repaid. Probably not, but it's possible. But if you listen to John Williams, right now the total national debt is, in fact, although the government says it's around $17 trillion, John Williams calculates that the real national debt right now is closer to $90 trillion. And if John Williams is right, and I believe he is, that averages out to $280,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. Now, you might be able to come up with $50,000. We might be able to come up with $50,000 per person across the country over 10 years to pay off $17 trillion. But we are not going to repay $280,000 per person right now or in the foreseeable future. It's simply not going to happen. The debt, if John Williams is correct, and the real national debt is approaching $90 trillion, it's not going to be paid in full under any circumstance. Not going to happen. And the Congressional Budget Office has also, Congressional Budget Office, they've calculated that including unfunded liabilities, the true national debt's about $202 trillion, and that calculation goes back to last year sometime. If you divide $202 trillion by the current population, 317 million, you wind up with an average fair share of the national debt of $650,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. Your fair share, your personal fair share of the debt is $650,000. Now, that doesn't count the debt you owe on your house or your car or your college education or any of your MasterCard or Visa. We're only talking about your fair share of the national debt. As if we do just simple mathematics, just divide the number provided by the Congressional Budget Office by the total population, and it averages out to $650,000 per person. If you have a family of four, you're going to, your fair share of the national debt will be about $2.4 million. Now, I don't know how many of you people have an extra $2.4 million to hand over to your buddies in government, but it won't be too many. And even if you have it, you're not going to want to give it up. But regardless of whether you have it or whether you want to give it up, the fact remains, look out the window. Count the next 1,000 people that walk by your home or your business or wherever you happen to be sitting. And take a stab at guesstimating how many of those people might have an extra $650,000 to pay Uncle Sam. And the answer is going to be very few. And the point of all of this is the debt is too great to be repaid. And in fact, if I had to guess, I'd say that if the debt is $90 trillion, as John Williams calculates, he's not using unfunded liabilities, just straight out debt. Government might be able to extract $25,000 a person out of us. They might be able to come up with that. They might even be able to come up with $50,000 per person over a decade, but it still leaves over $200,000 that won't be paid. It means that at minimum 80% of the debt won't be paid. And when we consider the $202 trillion that's allegedly owed according to the Congressional Budget Office, including unfunded liabilities, and it averages out to $650,000 per person, it translates into 90% of that debt can't be paid. It's not going to be paid. And I've harped on this over the years with a simple idea that what can't be paid won't be paid. All right, which seems obvious, but for me it's a profound statement, perhaps of the obvious, but still of truth. And it's significant for this reason. Every bit of the debt is memorialized by a piece of paper. Somebody has promised to pay that debt. Someone else is the intended beneficiary, the guy who's going to get the money back. He loaned the government, who knows, $100,000 in the form of a bond. And he's got a piece of paper with someone's signature on it, and he gave $100,000 of his time, his effort, his real wealth that had accumulated one way or another. He gave that to the government. The government promised to pay him $100,000, but I'm betting you that before this is done, that $100,000 note that he's carrying and that he treats as an asset will be shown to be worth no more than maybe $10,000, $20,000 tops, and it could be worth less than that. But he's going to lose at least 80% of his assets, and more likely 90%, maybe more than that. Because one man's debt is another man's asset. All right? If we cancel any of the debt, if we void it, if we say we can't pay it, if we repudiate it, however you want to put, whatever words you want to put on that, once we've canceled the debt, we've also wiped out the value of the correlative paper debt instruments that people are walking around with. They've got them in their safety deposit boxes. They've got them in the safe at home. They've got them tucked under their bed. And they say, I am a wealthy man because I've got a piece of paper, somebody's signature on it, that they're promising to pay me this debt. Only the debt can't be paid in full, and it can't even be paid in a majority sense. They can't even pay 50% of the existing debt. They are going to be lucky if they can pay 10-20% top of the existing debt. What's the point to all this? The point is that if you are holding, we don't know this is true for every debt in paper debt instrument. I don't doubt that some of them are going to do okay. Some of them may even do very well. But I have no doubt that the vast majority, and by vast majority I mean 90% or more, of the paper debt instruments are going to be shown to be virtually worthless within some time in the foreseeable future. I can't tell you when it's going to happen, but I can tell you that mathematically it's a virtual certainty. It's either that or there's a way that you can come up with an extra $650,000 to hand over to Uncle Sam. Do you have it? Do you know anyone who does? And if you've got it for yourself, do you have an extra $650 for your wife and for your two kids? It can't be paid, and that means those correlative paper debt instruments are going to be shown to be worthless. And what does that tell us? It tells us that sooner or later, that paper is going to just turn into nothing. And the only people who will be able to preserve their wealth are those who have stored their wealth in a tangible form. You can put it into land, you can put it into food, you can put it into tools, and maybe into a factory, but something that you own physically, and that includes gold and silver. The day is coming, and I don't know that it's, again, no one knows when that date is. I don't know. But could it be 5 years away? Does anyone think we could be 5 years before we go, before we face a moment when people say, golly, we can't pay that debt? Is it 5 years away? I have a hard time believing that's even possible. 3 years? Maybe. It's not impossible. Who knows? But it could happen before this year's out. It could happen next year. We are under strange and fragile circumstances where if this system suddenly goes south, we could, you know, have one of those catastrophic moments where all of a sudden, oh my gosh. And it'll disappear in no time at all. And those of you that are holding pieces of paper and using those pieces of paper to store your wealth, you are going to be bitterly disappointed. And those of you that are using gold and silver to store your wealth are going to be extraordinarily pleased. And the people in your family who depend on you, they're going to say, oh my gosh, you know, how about Dad was a nut? But now it turns out he was really pretty smart because he put his wealth into gold and silver, and now we are able to sell that gold and silver, spend it in ways that help to keep the family alive. I want to remind you that we have specials at Discount Gold and Silver every day, or virtually every day, and today's special is one almost uncirculated $5 Liberty. That's a quarter ounce. Just a shade under a quarter ounce of gold. $25 face value of 90% silver. One silver eagle, shipping included, for $815. The $5 Liberty coin is in almost uncirculated condition. They're in limited supply and contain nearly a quarter ounce of pure gold. The $25 face value, 90% silver. These are silver coins, and they were the basis for our currency for hundreds of years until 1965, when the price of silver started increasing. The value of government replaced our silver with coins made of worthless metal. But even though they did that, they're still around and they're available. So you get a quarter ounce of gold, very nearly, just a shade under a quarter ounce. $25 face value and 90% silver, a free silver eagle, 1 ounce containing 99.9% pure silver for $815. If you don't want to be caught in the day when the paper turns out to be worthless, get yourself some tangible wealth. Give Melody a call at Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. I'll be right back with our guest, James Corbett. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. For all your gold and silver coin needs, give Melody a call. 1-800-375-4188. Our guest today is James Corbett. He's the author of The Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. CorbettReport.com. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004, started the Corbett Report in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased Bob Chapman. Well, James, how are you doing?
James? I'm doing pretty well, Alfred. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, pleasure. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Let's start with something. Here's something from Obama. Not a new Cold War, but new Russian sanctions announced. Right? He says we're not going into another Cold War. We've got another report here from Reuters, and the headline is, Russia may ban car imports if West applies new sanctions. Now, what's really going on here? Are we going into a new Cold War, or is this kind of a temporary blip? And as soon as things cool out in the Ukraine, will it be business as usual with Russia and between Russia and the United States and so on? Or are we setting up some sort of permanent divisions? What do you think?
Well, the economic new Cold War is already a fait accompli. There's no debate about this. And, of course, if the President of the United States actually made some sort of formal announcement of a new Cold War, that would be a different level of Cold War entirely, which is why I think that type of statement is just diplomatically held back. But I think it's an on-the-ground reality that, well, farmers and agricultural producers of various types in Europe and Australia and Canada and the United States are feeling right now because of the new import sanctions on their foodstuffs that Russia just recently implemented. And if fact, the latest on this I just tweeted out yesterday, China, India to replace Canada, Australia, U.S. as meat suppliers to Russia, in which they're talking about how they're going to be sourcing their meat from China and India from now on. And even if the sanctions are to be lifted, they're hoping to make this more of a permanent transition towards some of their BRICS brethren. So that, again, I think is just another sign of what we've been documenting here week after week on the program, which is that bifurcation of the world into the U.S. bloc, I guess, and the BRICS bloc, or again, however you want to define it. And this is just another sign of that, another ramification of what's going on.
Are we really dealing with a bifurcation? Is it that simple right now, or do we have multiple? We've got Russia, for example, as a potential long-term adversary. We've got the rebels in the Middle East. They're also in the mix. How many conflicting entities do we have right now that are significant and worth counting?
Well, you're right to bring up that point of skepticism, because it's never quite that simple, and there are a lot of different ways that this could fracture. I think we're we're being led to believe that there is a growing bifurcation, or a growing group of two competing power blocks, but it's certainly, I don't think either power block is quite so well defined, even as they want it to be defined. And again, I think that we can see this in a lot of different ways. If you approach it from the military angle, then obviously you're looking at NATO and the NATO member countries and their encirclement of China and Russia, which can be documented over the past couple of decades. Or if you look at it economically, again, you could look at certain trade pacts, or you could look at the European Union and their negotiations with America and America's negotiations with the Asia Pacific nations and the TPP, those types of those blocks versus the BRICS block, for example. There's a lot of different ways that you could look at that, and they come out with slightly different players. Some of the core players are the same in each one. I mean, obviously, the Anglo-American alliance is going to be pitted against the Russian-Chinese alliance in most of these. But again, there are forces pressing outward from these centers, so that, for example, even the European Union or the Eurozone is not so much a coherent entity as we are led to believe it is. And there is a lot of pressure from some of the peripheral nations that would stand probably more obviously to benefit from a financial and trading relationship with Russia than they are to benefit with some of their other European nations. So, again, it's not so quite so simple, but I think that there are ways that we can see that in all of these different conflicts and contests and competing powers in different sections of the globe, they do tend to, there is an increasing tendency to get them to side with one or another of these two main power blocks, however loosely defined they may be, so that even, for example, in the Middle East, it becomes Russia supporting Syria, or it becomes Saudi Arabia supporting the rebels, the insurgents, the terrorists in Syria, or that type of thing, so that we can again put this into that same power block relation and sort of divide things up that way. But as I say, I mean, it is much more complicated, and it's certainly by no means set in stone what the battle lines will be for the next war.
We can wonder how long term any of these alliances really are. I mean, it's not as if we can sit back and say that China and Russia are necessarily going to be good buddies for the next 20 years. We can wonder, how soon will these alliances break down? How stable are they? One of the great things about the Cold War, if you could say there was something great about the Cold War, was the idea that we had one coherent adversary. From our government's perspective, it was very helpful. It was almost ideal. They have one enemy, the evil Russian or communist empire. But right now, you mentioned the need for clarity. It's not quite clear who our adversaries are exactly. And when we have more than one, we could be after the terrorists, we might be after the Russians, who are we going after? It doesn't lend itself to the kind of storyline that worked well during the Cold War. We can't easily deal with multiple adversaries. It's a lot easier to galvanize public support when we have just one evildoer, one villain. And I'm wondering, who do you suppose is going to be the long-term villain Or will we have the villain du jour, the villain, per week, one new villain every week, we have a new villain? What do you suppose is going to happen?
It's a really important question, because obviously the answer to that question will determine the sort of, not just the course of politics over the coming decades, but really the face of those politics, in the way that the Cold War kind of defined the battle lines for the globe in terms of ideology in the 20th century. And I think that there are multiple answers that are possible. It is certainly possible that if things maintain their current trajectory, that Russia will be the boogeyman. And obviously that's the way things are looking right now. I think longer term, I think it must have something more fundamentally to do with China, given its economic position and its growing economic clout. I think it will be more situated to be a stronger force on the international stage than Russia is, in at least economically speaking. And I would really take a look more closely at China and the various alliances it's attempting to build. But then it's always possible that it could be something completely different. I mean, that's something that we can't even really comprehend on the world stage at this point. And who knows? I mean, there's always the sort of dark horse candidates out there that you don't really expect, that could come out of, not come out of nowhere, but could take you by surprise, in the same way that China would not have been bandied about as an economic powerhouse or any other type of powerhouse just a couple of decades ago. In the same way, we might be writing off places like India, which certainly are, economically speaking, and still in a bit of a shambles, but that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be the possibility of pulling something out of that hat, and India becoming a new type of power in the mid-21st century, or that type of thing. So again, there's a lot of different ways that it can go. All things being equal and the trajectory being what it is, it's clear that Russia is being set up as the boogeyman at this point. But again, I don't think that's that long-term that makes the most convenient narrative for the people who would stand to benefit from some type of new Cold War scenario.
We see this multiplicity. They are multiple in theory. You know, depending on your perspective, there are multiple bad guys. Some people are going to say we're the bad guys. We're going to say Russia's the bad guy. A terrorist, the bad guy. We can point to some others probably. Does this multiplicity, is this favorable or contrary to the organizing principle of a new world order? Is this evidence, when we see these multiple alliances and whatever, is that evidence that the new world order is fragmented? It's not making progress right now? Or is it just a temporary bump in the road? Or is it irrelevant to the new world order? What do you think?
Well, let's approach it from the lens of literature, where we could, of course, take the example of 1984, oft cited in our current day and age, where the world system was held in some sort of balance by those broad groupings, Oceania and East Asia and Eurasia, these broad regional sorts of governments that existed in that world. And I think that's ultimately where I think we are heading, geopolitically speaking. I don't think there's any way around it if things maintain their current course. And from that perspective, I think that having this somewhat uncertain and alliances that are prone to shifting can be an effective tool for the people who want to control vast swaths of the population, to keep them in that state of unbalance, which actually serves, I think, ultimately to play into the hands of those who want to keep the fear going and to keep the uncertainty going as a way of propagating their control over that society. And in the 1984 world, that works by propagating, we're at war with East Asia, we've always been at war with East Asia, we're at war with Eurasia, we've always been at war with Eurasia. And the suggestion is made in the book that, in fact, the bombings that take place from time to time are not actually perpetrated by any outside entity. They're perpetrated by the government themselves in order just to keep people scared. And, of course, that's always a phenomenon that we have to at least be wary of, because, again, it's a well-documented historical phenomenon of false flag terrorism and that sort of thing. So I think it certainly can play into a system of world, if not world government, in the complete one totality of one single unitary world government, at least in a world system that maintains control over, you know, various regions, and who knows what the cooperation between those regions may be, you know, above or below the table.
You know, we've got a motto that's attributed to the New World Order. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but if that attribution is accurate or not, but they talk about out of chaos, order. And we certainly seem to, in other words, when the world seems to go into enough chaos, it will look for a single authoritarian source to come impose some sort of order. So the idea, if we can create enough chaos, we can eventually rule. That is the theory behind this. The question is, we certainly see enough chaos in the world today. The amount of chaos seems to be growing and accelerating. But is this chaos controlled chaos? Or is it real chaos? Or even the New World Order, they're saying, I don't know what to do with these people. They're all going nuts. So what do we have here? Do we have real chaos or do we have contrived chaos? What do you think?
Well, do we have to really choose between one or the other? Cannot both be the case at the same time? I am certainly not one of those people who posits that every single thing that takes place in the world is part of some grand plan. I think there are genuine things that happen that have not been predicted or engineered to happen in the first place. But it is really just the question of how those types of events are used to further an agenda that already exists, or whether or not it hinders that agenda. And unfortunately, again, I think that the system that we're facing of the drive towards globalization and global governments and increasing centralization of control is helped out by any type of crisis in which people basically turn to authorities and leaders for some sort of solution that they can't provide for themselves, or at least believe that they can't provide for themselves. So that in the wake of an economic emergency like what happened a few years ago, of course, what do we see except massive stimulus and bailouts to the banks? And of course, further centralization of control in entities like the Bank for International Settlements through the creation of the Financial Stability Board and other such entities, and the expansion of the G8 into the G20, and the sort of shakeup of the world order through mechanisms like that. In that case, again, I think there was obviously a deliberate engineering of the bubble which brought about that crisis. But even if we were to imagine that that was just all happenstance, and wouldn't you know it, somehow it got out of control of the government regulators and what have you. Even
but
if
it wasn't
believe
their
that,
fault, it was an accident, of course.
Right, of course. But even if it was just an accident, it doesn't really matter in the end, because either way, they're, of course, able to use that to further that agenda that, again, already exists. And that's a very dangerous situation, because basically any calamity, any bad thing that happens can help further that agenda. The only way that that agenda can fall apart then would be the opposite. If things go extremely well, too well, if everything happens wonderfully and for the benefit of the people, and people become richer and happier and less inclined to go along with whatever politicians tell them to do because of emergency crisis, then there will be a drastic change in that agenda. But unfortunately, as we've seen over the past century at least, it's been a century of calamity after calamity and disaster after disaster. And in each case, it seems to further centralize control.
I think one of the things we can talk about when we return, we've got major governments and forces that try to take advantage of whatever calamity they may see. They try to exploit it for their own benefit. Well, one, I'll ask you when we come back, is this a dangerous tendency? It's like, if I think I can make money every time I set a house on fire, how long before I set my own house on fire? If you catch my drift. I mean, isn't this a dangerous strategy? We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements before we get back and try to get an answer. I'm Alfred Adisk here on Financial Survival. I'm here with my guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Everyone Everyone is afraid of pain. No one wants pain to rule over their life. And you don't want the negative side effects of aspirin, ibuprofen, or prescription drugs. They can lower immunity and cause dependency. Is there a safe alternative? I'm herbalist Wendy Wilson, and I prefer willow bark and meadow sweet herbs to control pain, fever, aches, and inflammation. God's herbs are good, and you won't be disappointed. Call Apothecary Herbs for pain or extra strength pain relief formula, toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International, 704-875-8010, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with my guest, James Corbett from The Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com, CorbettReport.com. We're talking about the idea that people in positions of power think they can exploit any crisis to their advantage. And the danger in that, in my opinion, is that you get in the habit of thinking you can handle nitroglycerin and you can even juggle it and, bounce it off your elbows and your knees and the rest of that, and pretty soon you're going to have a serious problem. We've had Hillary Clinton and Rahm Emanuel back. This goes back probably 3 years ago now, but they were both caught making the statement that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And I'm just wondering, is that hubris? Is that too much? Is it irrational? If you don't think a crisis is something to worry about and be concerned about and try to stop it, you think, no, we got it all under control. We can control this. We can exploit this. How long before it blows up in your face? Do you think a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, or should it just be solved and be done with it? What do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously we all want to solve problems and preferably prevent them, or you would think that would be the motivation. And I guess it depends on what we're trying to do. If we're trying to genuinely solve the problems in our society, then obviously prevention is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But for the people who want to change society itself or change the goalposts or change people's perceptions or consciousness, then sometimes crisis is the only way to do that. And in fact, that was something that was highlighted by a committee, a congressional committee that was investigating some of the large foundations back in the 1950s. It was called the Reese Committee. And one of the researchers for that committee, Norman Dodd, gained access to the annals of the Carnegie Endowment from its inception in 1908, in which the board minutes recorded what the board members were talking about at the inception of that Carnegie Endowment. And it was stunning, according to the testimony, again, of this lead researcher for this congressional committee, what was discovered in those records, which was that throughout the course of that first year of the Carnegie Endowment back in 1908, the board debated in a most scholarly and learned fashion the best way to change a society, to change a society's perceptions or what it deems to be feasible. And after that year of debate, scholarly learned debate, they came to the conclusion that no better course than war itself can be found for changing a society. Yeah. And from that point, they started debating, well, what is the best way to steer America into a war? Which, as Norman Dodd noted in, I think, a famous interview, or what should be a famous interview with G. Edward Griffin that was conducted about 30 years ago now, he said, well, there, nothing could have been further from the mind of the average American back at that time than how to steer America into a war. And yet here it was being debated by some of the, well, people who had access to some of the greatest wealth ever accumulated in the history of mankind. Obviously a scary concept, but one that, again, I think we have to understand from the perspective of people who do want to change society fundamentally. And as we've been saying, the crisis creates the opportunity for that change in what people believe or what people feel to be possible and what people are willing to allow in order simply to stop the crisis from continuing. Now, I guess if the question is, can a crisis be created that it's so out of control that it cannot be stopped, I think obviously the answer has to be yes, especially in an age where we literally do have the technology to completely destroy the Earth many times over. All it takes for something of that sort to happen is a military escalation that gets out of the control of the would-be controllers, and before you know it, it's the end of the human species. So obviously, I mean, the stakes on this could not be higher, and the idea that you can play with fire and continue to harness it for indefinitely, no matter what happens, is, of course, as you say, it's hubris and exceptionally scary, because, as we know, I mean, people who gravitate towards the top of really any industry or field, but obviously politics in particular, tend to be high-functioning sociopaths or psychopaths who genuinely do have an ability and an interest in manipulating others for their own ends and purposes. And unfortunately, again, these are tend to be the type of people who have inadequate understanding of risk, we'll say, in order in terms of what they understand about what is possible and their own fallibility. And these are exactly the type of people you do not want in those positions of power, and yet we find them there anyway. So this is, I mean, this is the broad perspective. And unfortunately, again, in the particulars, I think so much of the infrastructure has been put in place to capitalize on any particular crisis that you can think of, from economic to military to social unrest. And again, we have to take a look at the way that the police forces across the United States have been militarized through billions of dollars of funding that has come directly from the Department of Homeland Security over the past decade, that we now see being paraded out in front of the public in Ferguson, where, again, I don't believe there was any conspiracy behind the incident that started that unrest and that tension in Ferguson, but clearly the crisis is being used to further the agenda of displaying and venerating, even bringing out the necessity, quote unquote, for the militarization of the police, because look at what they're dealing with. This is, again, I think part and parcel of what we're talking about, and it goes to show that it doesn't necessarily even matter what particular spark sets off the reaction. It's just the fact that the reaction has already been thought about in advance.
So people are ready to take advantage. They don't know necessarily where the spark is going to start the tinder on fire. But they are prepared to take advantage when that spark, it's like forest fires. We know that the lightning is going to start some forest fires. We don't know exactly where or when, but some of them are going to start on fire, and there are people that are prepared to take advantage of that. It's dangerous for all of us.
Ferguson matter in particular, we should also note that it's not simply mere happenstance what's happening there. There is now the suggestion coming from the State Highway Patrol Captain Ron Johnson himself that many of the people who are taking part in the violent protests and are provoking the police reaction that we're seeing are people that are coming from out of state, from as far away as, quote, New York and California, end quote. So clearly there is some outside manipulation that is taking place here in terms of what's going on the ground. And that's another way in which these types of scenarios, even a crisis that may be limited or contained in one sense, could actually be provoked or furthered from the outside in order to gain that sense of crisis which is needed to further the agenda.
And it is sad, tragic, ironic, whatever word you want to put on it,
that it appears that it may be that the original reports are inaccurate. It may be that the original report is that Michael Brown was shot several times in the back, or at least that was some of the original reports. Now it becomes clear he was shot in the front. We don't know if he was charging. We don't know what was going on there for an absolute fact, but this is no longer a situation. It may be that the police weren't completely wrong, and I'm no fan of the police, but the police might have been the policeman who did the shooting. It may be that truly it is a justifiable homicide. Now, I don't know that that's true, but it might be, and yet, even if it is true, it's triggered a reaction that's been building that's critical of the police, and perhaps critical of a police state and critical of militarization. And the police, ironically, might have been right, and yet, as an institution, they're going to suffer some damage because of this event in Ferguson. So what do you think? Is that just an oddity, or is this evidence of a growing awareness of a police state in this country and people sitting back say, look, we've had enough of it. We can't keep putting militarized police on the street, and this is the flashpoint, even if it isn't a rational flashpoint. This is the one that's going to maybe make some change. You follow what I'm saying there, James?
I do, and I think you're right to point out that at this point, this is no longer about the death of Michael Brown in particular. Oh. That was clearly the flashpoint which caused the unrest, but the unrest was obviously already there and already simmering, and this is something that's just tapped into that. And now, I mean, it's gone even beyond that resentment that might have been there towards the police in particular, or just in general, into the particular instance of what's going on in Ferguson now with the sort of militarized police and the types of things that we're seeing now, where there's clear provocations going on with officers pointing live guns at people who are unarmed and doing nothing and telling them, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, I understand. I saw it on video.
Yeah, saw the video. Pretty remarkable things that are happening right now.
Astonishing.
Yeah. And one has to wonder. One has to wonder to what extent the orders are coming down from somewhere higher up, that there is some leeway in these matters and to provoke the situation. Because, again, I mean, we've seen provocations of CNN reporters live on national TV being ordered around and things that certainly don't play into the PR image that you would expect the police force would want, but that certainly is serving to infiltrate the consciousness of the American public that this is a different time and we are entering police state USA. So if the ultimate aim is to get people to understand that we are in a militarized police state in this day and age, I think that's being accomplished in spades with this.
You know, you mentioned something along the lines of whether you were questioning whether someone is in control and making this happen. In a sense of a puppeteer that's saying, this is what I want exactly. I don't know that you get the kind of control where you can absolutely orchestrate what's going to take place. But it's like having two cats. And if you can manage to wrangle those two cats into the same gunny sack and close the opening to the gunny sack, you should not be surprised if the two cats start fighting. We may not know which cat's going to win and how this is going to work out, but you can predict if you can get them in the gunny sack, there's going to be a problem. To my mind, I think that may be the kind of control they're exerting. They're just saying, let's get these cats in the gunny sack and see what happens.
I think the obvious analogy in that regard would be Abu Ghraib and what happened there, where everything that was set up institutionally and in terms of the directives that were coming from the Pentagon about how to handle prisoners and all of those things were set up at the highest levels. But then it was the people at the very lowest levels who were the prison guards, basically, who ended up shouldering all of the responsibility for what happened there, which, of course, is the complete inversion of where the real power dynamics lay in that situation. And I think similarly, again, when it comes to policing on the ground, I don't think there's any one puppet master who's telling each policeman what to do. But clearly there's an institutional understanding that emerges when officers are given their rules and terms of engagement, so, quote unquote, so to speak, with the public.
You put them under enough stress, and they're going to overreact, and you can exploit those overreactions. I've got one last headline here to talk about before we run out of time. We've got about 2 minutes left, maybe three. Putin to meet with Ukrainian President Poroshenko. After months of tensions between Ukraine and Russia, Russian President Putin, Ukrainian President Poroshenko will meet face-to-face. This won't take place until August 26th. 6 days from now, we're not quite a week. Does this signal that maybe we're going to get a resolution in the Ukraine?
It is at least a possibility. Certainly, if this wasn't taking place, there would be nothing on the table. So it's at least on something that could potentially eventuate. And let's hope that it does, because, again, no matter what the tensions are and how they've developed and how they've been provoked and by whom, it's clearly in the interest of everyone at this point to come to some sort of agreement and some sort of understanding, to back away even slightly from what's happening right now, so that hopefully we can find some sort of resolution that doesn't involve further ratcheting up the conflict, which is the only way that we've seen forward so far. And it's best, I think, the best possible outcome would be one that's agreed to directly between Putin and Poroshenko, because obviously I think those are the two powers with the most at stake in what's going on directly, rather than having the European Union or the United States involved in that type of negotiation.
I've got one more here. We've got a minute left before we close down. Ukraine says army controls center of a rebel city. This is in the New York Times. And they refer to the pro-Russia rebels' disintegrating virtual state. Has Russia abandoned the rebels on the east side of the Ukraine? Is that what's happening right now? Or are they merely being overpowered by the Ukrainian government? They were originally making great headway. Now they're in the, now things are not working for them. Has Russia abandoned these rebels? I know they're caught with them. It's like you got to bring your family, you got to bring your relatives to the next christening or something. You might not want to, but you have to bring them along. What do you think? And we've got 10 seconds.
Long story short, I think there's nothing that Russia could do short of full-on military intervention that would ultimately help support these rebels or separatists or whatever you want to call them. So I think that Russia has done what it can and is doing what it can, but I don't think it could do anything more without provoking full-on war.
All right, James, thanks very much. We always appreciate having you on the program. This is James Corbett from The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, Report, CorbettReport.com. Thanks again. I'm Alfred Addis, guy here on Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord, bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.